For several weeks, we've been in a series titled God is Near. And so it's going to be a while longer still as we go through this. In a very general way, all of the messages are focused on the idea that God is near. He knows what we're going through. He is not only near enough to hear us when we speak to Him, He is near enough to speak and to share with us. He is there to comfort. He is there to lead, guide, and direct. He's there to draw people that don't know Him to Himself. But as we go through the series of messages, we're looking at individuals and how individuals interacted with God, how He spoke to them, how He appeared to them, what they do in response. And so right now we're still in Genesis, and we have been for a while. This week and next week we'll finish what we're doing in Genesis, and we'll move on. And in time, we'll spend a bit of time with Moses. We'll spend some time with the Hebrews in the wilderness. We'll talk about the law being given. The law isn't bad. We need to remember it was a gift from God at that time. It was His word. It was meant for His people, and it was to be a blessing to His people that were given the law. No other nation, no other people had that. They were His chosen people. And God said, I will be with you, I will be near you. I will establish my covenant. I will make my dwelling place among you. And so in a very general way, we've been talking about God being near. And then we've been looking specifically at individuals that God dealt with. So today, we're just going to call this Intro to Joseph. We've talked about the God of Abraham and that relationship. We've talked about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Last week, we looked at Jacob's covenant with God and Jacob's name being changed to Israel. And it is those children of Israel, for the most part, that become the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel. There's a little bit of difference there because there is no tribe of Joseph. So today we're going to be introduced to Joseph. He's not the youngest son of Jacob, but he's the second to the youngest. Benjamin is the baby. Joseph is one of the youngest of all the children of Israel, or the sons of Jacob. We're going to be introduced to Joseph today, and then hopefully next week we'll finish with Joseph, and we'll understand his part in what God is doing. That's one thing to keep in mind. As we look at Joseph today, as we're introduced to Joseph, as we see some hardships, as we see some defeats and victories in Joseph's personal life, it comes in the middle of what God has promised Abraham was going to happen. You know, at Genesis 15, God reveals in incredible detail a lot to Abraham. We are usually not so blessed to know what God is going to be doing for the next 400 years, and specifically the role that we play in it. But at Joseph's lifetime, this is Abraham's great-grandson. And he's going to have a major part in how the nation of Israel gets to be in Egypt. And God told Abraham back when that in 400 years his descendants would come back to that place. God really sort of let us into his mind when he says to Abraham, I will use your descendants to punish the wrongdoings of the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hittites and others, but they've not yet completed all of the sins that I'm going to punish them for. I will use your descendants to bring judgment, but it's kind of like waiting for fruit to get ripe on the tree. He's like, they're not ready to be judged yet, but they will be. And it's interesting that as Joshua is about to lead the Hebrews into Canaan, there was a warning to the children of Israel. I'm going to punish all of these inhabitants of the land for these things that they've done. And he lists all of their sins. And he warns Israel that if you do these things, I will punish you also. And Israel did. And God did as he promised. But there was a warning. He's like, I'm going to wipe out the inhabitants of this land for committing these sins. And there's a chapter there, in I believe in Numbers, where he's like, here's every sin you could possibly imagine. And this is what the people of the land have done. Don't do these things. And you can almost read into, you can almost see, he's like, I'm going to tell you not to do these things, but I know you're going to do them. And if you do, I'll punish them. And God knew what was going to happen, as sure as he did. But let's slow down. Let's focus on the little picture. Because Joseph's life and these events fit into what God had done and what God was going to do. But Joseph couldn't see the whole picture. Sometimes we are too close to something to fully understand what's going on. I've used the analogy before of going to a football game. If you're seated in the third or fourth row at the 50-yard line, you have a good view of the field. You know when the receivers are running in the wrong direction. You know when the play didn't happen that the quarterback called out. It's easy to sit at home watching our big screen TV and coach. Anybody can coach from their armchair. But when you're on the field, you can't see everything the guys at home with instant replay can see. When you're on the field and people are shouting and the adrenaline is flowing because it's the intensity of the moment, you don't get a good, clear picture of the whole entire field. You can't see where everybody is and everything that's going on. Joseph is a part of the picture, if you will, that God is painting. And he doesn't understand how the events in the lives of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob are being fulfilled through what is going on in his life at the moment. And he doesn't see how God is going to use those terrible things that happen in his life to bring about his will and to be a blessing to many in the future. We can see it because we can step back and look at the whole picture. Well, let's step forward for just a moment and look at the details. And then next week and in time to come, we can step back and view perhaps the big picture, if you will. We're going to read just a few verses in Genesis chapter 37. You see there, we're going to look at portions of 37 and 39 and 40 and 41, and I'm not going to read out loud from the pulpit four chapters out of Genesis. But if you begin at Genesis chapter 7, 37, verse 1, Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob, and now we're introduced to Joseph. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel, this is Jacob, renamed as Israel. Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. If you're a parent, or if you've taught school, you've been warned about having favorites. Now I'll tell you a secret. School teachers all have a favorite. We're just not allowed to tell anybody. One time when the principal was warning us not to have favorites, I asked him if I could have a least favorite. And he says, Clark, we all have least favorites. Jacob unapologetically let all of his children know that Joseph was his favorite. Well, we know what that's going to do. That's going to cause the other kids to dislike him. They're going to resent that. They're going to be jealous. So Jacob makes Joseph a coat of many colors because he's an old man and Jacob is almost the youngest child. His brothers saw that the father loved him more than all his brothers. They hated him and could not speak peaceably at him. And then it gets worse. Some things maybe you ought to just keep to yourself. But Joseph is 17 years old. What teenager didn't think they already knew everything? Frank and I talked about that This morning, kids growing up in high school think that's the whole world. Who would talk to you, what group you belong to, who wasn't speaking to you, who liked who is accepted by who. Those are big deal to teenagers. And in adulthood, we realize most of those friends from high school aren't the people we keep up with for the rest of our life. But in your wisdom of adulthood, you can't say that to a high school student and them understand. It's one of those ironies. You have to learn certain lessons for yourself. Joseph had a dream in verse 5. It doesn't say right here that God was revealing this to him as a vision. And at this point in the scripture, Joseph is not interpreting the dreams. He tells his brothers that he had a dream. Might should have just kept that to himself. I tell people I have three rules for success. Number one is never tell everything that you know. Let's move on. Joseph had a dream in verse 5, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." Joseph has this dream, and he's telling his brothers about it, and he doesn't see the potential problem here. And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. They already didn't like him because he was daddy's favorite. And now he has a dream which seems to suggest they will bow down to him. And they are going to, and we'll get to that part of the story next week. Then he dreams still another dream in verse 9 and told it to his brother, saying, "Look, I've dreamed another dream. And this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream you have dreamed?" Now he was his father's favorite, but the idea that the father is going to bow down to the son didn't sit well with Jacob. "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your 11 brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And the 11 brothers, his brothers, envied him, and his father kept the matter in mind. Now, I'll tell you what that reminds me of. Joseph has had this dream. It's two different dreams, and they're very similar. But in the second one, even his father and mother bowed down to him. The brothers envied him. But it says that his father kept this matter in mind. What does that mean? He thought about it. The situation was over. The kids all went to their rooms or had supper or went out in the field to work. And Jacob dwelt on this issue. He kept it in mind. He thought about it. He studied it, perhaps, to see if he could understand what it meant. When the wise men come to visit Mary and Joseph and Jesus, they come from afar. They offered precious gifts. They bow down and worship the infant child Jesus. And the Bible tells us that Mary kept these things and pondered them in her heart. She held on to it. She didn't forget. She studied it and tried to understand it. And that's what verse 11 reminded me of. It obviously means something. And Jacob contemplates what that meaning is. In a hurry-up world, we're told to be still and know that He is God. Sometimes a little meditation or contemplation wouldn't hurt us any. And then in verse 12, the brothers went to feed their flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to them, "Here I am." So he goes where the father sends him. In verse 15, a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in a field. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they're feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They've departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So we're going to move our story to Lower Alabama. No, I'm just kidding. Joseph went and found them in Dothan. Now, in verse 18, They saw him afar off. Even before he came near, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild thing has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard it. And if we'd read the entire story, you'd know that Reuben is the oldest son. Out of all the children of Jacob, Reuben is the oldest, and perhaps he has some wisdom. He knows that will devastate their father. The plan is to kill Joseph and cover the story up with his scheme to make Jacob think he's been devoured by some wild animal. He's been ripped to shreds. Reuben, it doesn't set well with him. Perhaps he has a little more sensitivity. Perhaps he has a little more maturity. Perhaps he's worried about the effect it will have on their father to learn the favorite child has been murdered. Even if they lie to him and say he was eaten by some animal. So Reuben says, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into the pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, because he was planning on rescuing him later and taking him back to the father." So it came to pass, when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic made of many colors that was on him. They took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes, and look, there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." You know, it is our brother. Maybe we shouldn't kill him. And if we kill him and he's dead, there's no profit. We can sell him to these guys for money. Now, who are the Ishmaelites? As we went through several chapters at a time of Genesis, we didn't stop and consider that story. But we've looked at it before. Paul, in the New Testament, uses Abraham's wife, Sarah, and Sarah's handmaiden, Hagar, to talk about the difference between the law and grace, to talk about two different covenants, one being freedom and the other one being bondage. Sarah had Isaac, and that was the child of promise. But Abraham also had a son through Hagar, and his name was Ishmael. And if you take the time to go back and look at that story, it was Sarah's idea. And as soon as she saw that Abraham had affection toward that son, she was jealous and treated Hagar badly. And eventually it comes to a head, and Sarah says, "You have to get rid of this woman and her son," after Sarah had her own son, Isaac. So they send them off. Here's some food, here's some water. Sent them out into the desert, basically to die. They're either going to go away or they're going to die trying to get away. It doesn't matter to Sarah as long as they're gone. And Hagar wraps up the baby and leaves it in the shade under a tree and goes over some distance and prays to God for mercy and asks that her and her child not die in the wilderness. And an angel appeared to her and said, "Indeed, your child will not die, but a great nation will be made of him also." Why? Because it's a son of Abraham. And Abraham had a covenant with God and said the world would be blessed through his descendants. "I'm going to make a great nation out of your son." Well, Abraham had two sons. The angel of the Lord appeals to Hagar and says, "A great nation will come from your son as well." Christian scholars and Arab scholars agree that the Arab nations the Muslim Arabs in Saudi Arabia and the Middle East are the descendants of Ishmael. The Ishmaelites in this verse are these guys' first cousins, two or three times removed. It's interesting that they share a part in this story of Joseph and his family and the children of Israel eventually going to Egypt. I'm not trying to make some grand point. Just know who the Ishmaelites are. They're going to be around for the rest of history. Because of Abraham and Sarah's partial obedience. They had faith, but they didn't have as much as they should. They did what God said, but they also did some other things. The Arab Muslims today are united by one common cause, and that's hating the Jews. Now, the Bible tells us they're going to be hated by all people in all nations, and we've certainly seen that to be true. But the thorn in their flesh, more than any other, is the Arab Muslims. And it goes back to the book of Genesis in the Bible. That tiny little area of land where Europe and Africa and Asia joined together. And the descendants of one man, Abraham, called by God and he responded in faith, is the hinge pin around which of all history of our world and humanity turns on. It's God's plan. He knew what he was doing. He still knows what he's doing. But, you know, I said we was going to step forward and take a look at the little picture. I'm sure backed way up since then. We're all details in a much bigger painting that you can't see all of. And through studying Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the beginnings of Israel, and their interaction with Hagar and Ishmael, and even this interaction between the children of Jacob and those Ishmaelites, reminds us that it takes a lot of little moving parts to make a great big thing. Peter says we're kind of like bricks in a wall. Each one of us is a brick. If you take out one, it might not make much difference. But if it didn't have any bricks, there wouldn't be a wall. The space shuttle is this huge, gigantic, massive thing, hundreds of millions of dollars. And it could go from 0 to 800 miles an hour within just a few seconds. But it's made up of many, many tiny little moving parts. And the failure of any one could mean disaster for the whole entire vehicle. Let's rejoin our story, already in progress. I've got a bad feeling, by the way, about making it through chapters 39, 40, and 41 this morning. It's okay. What we don't do next week, we'll do the week after that. They sell their brother into slavery. They tear up his coat of many colors. They dip it in the blood of an animal. They go back to Jacob. All of his sons and daughters tried to comfort him. Jacob would not be comforted. If you finish reading chapter 37, he makes the statement, "I will go down to Sheol, mourning the death of my son." Genesis chapter 38 takes its own sidebar. It's about Judah and his wife, and it gets really weird, and he sleeps with a prostitute, and we're just going to move on to 39 this morning. Joseph is a slave in Egypt. He is sold into the house of Potiphar. Look at chapter 39, verse 1. Joseph had been taken to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Everything that Potiphar puts into his hand prospers because God was with him. His brothers hated him. They wanted to kill him. They sold him as a slave instead. He sent out of their country into Egypt, and he's bought by the captain of Pharaoh's guard. But then he rises to a position of prominence and power. Because God is with him, it's like King Midas. Everything he touched turned to gold. So eventually, he is ruling over all of Potiphar's business. He's running the house. The only thing Potiphar had to worry about was the food that he put in his mouth, and Joseph was taking care of everything else. Joseph ends up doing pretty well, despite the fact that he's been sold into slavery. But then, it happened at that time in verse 11, when Joseph went to the house to do his work, none of the men of the house were inside. I've skipped ahead. Where'd it go? Back in verse 7, we're not given her name, but Potiphar's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and invited him to come lie with her. What does Joseph say? In verse 9, there is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you were his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Look what Joseph's motivations are. He says, I can't do that to my master Potiphar. He doesn't say, I can't sin against Potiphar. He doesn't say, the master of this house has been very good to me. I owe him this. He says, I can't do this thing and sin against God. In one of the Psalms, David writes that no matter what person he has offended, it is God that he has sinned against. Think about that. We're told to go out in the world and be light. That's what our Sunday school lesson was. Sometimes you'll hear about in our culture, not we, collective we have this notion of a victimless crime. Well, this shouldn't even be illegal because there's no victim. There doesn't have to be a victim for the issue to be of morality. David said, no matter what person I have offended, it is God that I have sinned against. Joseph says, I can't do this thing because it would be sin against God. So one day down in verse 11, there was nobody else around, and she grabbed a hold of him. Joseph is described as being a very attractive man. At the end of verse 6, he was handsome in form and appearance. And one day when there was nobody else around, Potiphar's wife was going to drag him to bed. And he slipped out of his garment and ran away. And she, being an opportunist, cried out. People ran to see what she was screaming about. And she comes up with this story about how the Hebrew was going to force himself on her. And he's like, see, I have his garment because I started screaming and he ran away. Here is my evidence. And with false evidence and trumped up charges, Joseph was cast into prison. Does everybody know what happens next? Joseph was as successful in prison as he had been in Potiphar's house. And eventually, the keeper of the prison has Joseph running everything. He is successful in all he does. Why? Because God was with him. God made him successful. He was a favorite of his father, Jacob. He was master of Potiphar's house. He's going to be the master of the prison. And by this time, he understands a little more about what God is doing, because he not only has dreams, he can interpret dreams. And he makes sure that people understand it isn't him, it's what God is doing. So, the butler and the baker are thrown into prison by the king of Egypt. The Pharaoh has cast these guys into prison, and they each have a dream. So join us, if you would, at chapter 40, in verse 8. They said to him, we each have had a dream, and there's no interpreter of it. So Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please. And there are other scriptures where it's clear that God gives dreams and he's the one that gives interpretations of the dreams. All the glory and honor belongs to God, not to Joseph or to anyone else that is used by God to do his will. So in verse 9, the chief butler told his dream to Joseph. He said, "In my dream, there was a vine before me, and the vine had three branches. It was as though it budded. Its blossoms shot forth, and clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. I took the grapes, pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." And Joseph said to him, "Here is the interpretation. The three branches are 3 days," he says in verse 12. "Now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner." It's going to be just like it was before when you were his butler or when you were his cup bearer. "But remember me. I don't belong in this prison. I shouldn't be here. Pharaoh is going to restore you as his cupbearer. When you get to Pharaoh, would you put in a good word?" That's what Joseph is saying. "Remember me when all is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house." And he gives him some backstory. He was stolen out of the land of Hebrews. He's done nothing that he should be put in the dungeon. And when the chief baker saw that his dream interpretation turned out nicely, he asked Joseph to interpret his dream for him as well. "I also was in my dream, and there were three white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head." So Joseph answered and said, "This is the interpretation of it. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you." The baker saw that the cupbearer got a good report. So he goes, do my dream. Did not have a happy ending. "It came to pass on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants." And the two things that Joseph said were going to happen happened exactly the way that Joseph said they would. He restored the chief baker, placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand, or he restored the cupbearer, he hanged the chief baker. Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. We never filled in the first blank, and I meant to. Joseph was a dreamer, and everything he did prospered. That's your first fill in the blank. Joseph was a dreamer. He had dreams, and he interpreted dreams. And everything he did prospered. And you might even add a footnote over there, because God was with him. But the very next line said God was with Joseph, so maybe that's not necessary. God was with Joseph, number one, in Potiphar's house. We're now at number two, in prison. God is going to be with Joseph one more time. 2 years later, we read in Genesis 41, Pharaoh has a dream. Pharaoh has a dream, and his wise men and magicians cannot interpret it for him. And then the cupbearer is like, "Oh yeah, now I remember my transgression. Oh, sorry, Pharaoh, please forgive me. I was supposed to tell you 2 years ago about this guy in prison that can interpret dreams. My bad. Sorry about that. I dropped the ball, but it's better he told him now than never." 2 full years. After being restored to his position, the cupbearer is able to tell Pharaoh, "Hey, there's a Hebrew in prison, and he can interpret dreams. We need to bring him up and see what he has to say about your dream." In Pharaoh's dream, there were 7 good, fat-looking cows. Fat babies, fat cows, these are good things, right? There are 7 plump, healthy-looking cows that are grazing. And 7 thin, sad, sickly-looking cows come up and consume them. But after the sad, thin cows ate the good cows, they didn't look any better. That was Pharaoh's first dream. In the second dream, there were 7 heads of grain on one stalk. In verse 7, they were plump and they were good. And in verse 8, 7 thin heads, blighted by the east wind, came up after them, and the 7 thin heads devoured the 7 plump and full heads. So Pharaoh wakes up, and he was dreaming. The magicians and the wise men of Egypt came in, cannot interpret his dream. In verse 9, the chief butler was like, "Oh yeah, now I remember. you need to talk to Joseph. So they bring Joseph out of the prison. He shaves, he takes a bath, they give him some clean clothes. Joseph answered Pharaoh in verse 16 of 41. We'll read this passage and we'll come to a stopping place. Joseph answered Pharaoh in saying, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace." Pharaoh tells the story of the dream again. In verse 25, Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh were one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. And the seven thin and the ugly cows come up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten, and the famine will deplete the land." And he tells him, because he had the same dream twice, it is a sure thing. God intends to do it. There's no way to prevent these events from happening. But what Joseph tells Pharaoh to do is use the time he's been given to prepare. God gave you this vision so you can be ready for what comes next. Build barns, build silos, and every year for the next 7 years, take back a fifth. Set 20% of that bountiful bumper crop, take all that extra production and put it aside. And then when the seven famine years come, we'll have all of these resources in store. You'll be prepared, and your people will be fed, and Egypt will not perish from the earth. Not only Egypt, but all the surrounding nations are going to come to Egypt because they hear they have food. And carefully managing these resources, they were able to provide for themselves and all the surrounding nations. So the famine and the destruction was not nearly as bad as it could have been. And Pharaoh says to Joseph, "This plan is wise. Who else is there in Egypt that has the Spirit of God with them like Joseph does?" Just like he had been in Potiphar's house, Joseph is elevated to a position almost equal to that of Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, "You'll be in command of all the nation of Egypt. Only the throne will not be yours." He says, "Let what Joseph has said be the law in the land." God was with Joseph in Potiphar's house, in prison, and number three, on the throne. Joseph has sort of a hard luck story. His brothers hated him. They wanted to kill him. They threw him in a pit. They sold him into slavery. God was with Joseph everywhere he went and in everything that he did. And that's sort of the close-up view we get of Joseph. In the immediate time at hand, everything Joseph did prospered, and people trusted him to manage and delegate responsibility and be in charge of their resources. In Potiphar's house, in the dungeon, and now Pharaoh puts everything into his hand and all the nation of Egypt. Why? Because God was with him in the short run. And as we step back and look at the whole picture, we see that that was part of what God was doing all along, and that plays a pivotal role in what God is going to do next. And to see what God does next, we'll just have to pick it up there next week. God is with you wherever you are, in the short term, in the long term. When we can see clearly what God is doing, and when we don't have a clue what God is doing, He is near enough to hear you cry out to Him. He is near enough to speak and to give comfort. And with the Holy Spirit dwelling in the heart of the believer, He is nearer to us today than any of these Old Testament characters that we'll read about. God is near when we get it, and when we don't get it. And when you're in the boat and the world is being flooded, God forbid if you're in prison. If they lie about you and take you to court and drum up false charges and present false evidence, God is with us. And when everything is good and everything is coming up roses and we're rejoicing and worshiping, God is with us. And he doesn't leave, and he's never so far removed that he does not remember his promises that he has made. God is faithful and just concerning his promises. He is not a man that he should lie. Let us pray together.